Hi again, everyone. This is Mark Movsesian. I'm the director of the Matone Center for Law and Religion at St. John's, and your host for another episode of Legal Spirits, our podcast series on cases and issues in law and religion. You can find past episodes on our website, which is lawandreligionforum.org, one word, and also on streaming platforms like Apple iTunes and Spotify, Android, and others. If you like us, please subscribe. In this episode, we're going to discuss a new documentary on the history of religious freedom in America, which is called Free Exercise, America's Story of Religious Liberty. The film premiered last month at Princeton University, specifically at Princeton's James Madison program, and I was fortunate enough to appear in a post-screening panel with Princeton's Robbie George and also with the film's narrator, Richard Brookhiser. So I asked Rick if he might join us to discuss the film, and to my delight, he said yes. Rick, I'm sure our listeners know who you are, but just by way of brief introduction, Rick is a journalist and historian, the author of several extremely well-regarded biographies of the framers, including Washington, Madison, and Hamilton. In fact, I think, Rick, it's fair to say that you started off the Hamilton craze. And also Governor Morris. Did I get that? Is it Governor Morris?
It's hard to say. Abigail Adams wrote it as Governor, and she spelled a lot phonetically. So I kind of go with that, but we don't know.
And also Abraham Lincoln.
Yes.
Rick has hosted documentaries on PBS, where I guess this new film will appear as well, although we'll talk about that a little bit later. His work appears regularly in leading opinion journals, and he's also a senior editor at National Review. Rick, again, I'm delighted to have you with us. Thanks so much for coming.
Thanks for having me.
Well, so let me tell you a little bit about the film. The film runs a couple of hours, and it relates to several important episodes in the history of religious freedom in the United States, going all the way back to colonial times. Now, religious freedom is a recurring issue in our history. Various minority groups have tested, and in fact, the film shows these groups have helped to shape the American commitment to religious freedom and pluralism, including Quakers, Baptists, Black Christians, Catholics, Jews, and Mormons. And of course, the question of religious freedom continues today for more newly arrived groups like Hindus, Buddhists, and Muslims. Now, it seems to me when you watch the film, you see that a certain pattern repeats itself again and again. Initial suspicion of a new minority religious group that over time, and not without serious conflict and even bloodshed, and not without courage and persistence on the part of the minority groups that insisted on their rights, transforms into acceptance and welcome, so that later generations wonder what all the fuss was about. And I think that it's an implicit message of the film that today, like our forebears, we may be able also to navigate our conflicts successfully over time. At least that's what I got from the film. But Rick, I want to ask you, why don't you tell us your general thoughts about the film? Why make the film now? And what do you see as some of the film's major themes?
Well, the film grew out of a chapter in one of my recent books, which was called Give Me Liberty. And this was a series of episodes in American, including colonial history, where I thought our commitment to liberty was defined. And one of those chapters had to do with an episode not in colonial British North America, but in New Netherland, in the Dutch colony, which was between New England and the Anglo settlers to its south. And this had to do with Quakers, who began appearing in this colony under the directorship of Peter Stuyvesant, who turned out to be its last director. He was an effective man in many ways. I think our film paints him as a pure villain, but he actually got the colony in shape, and he did a lot of good things with it. But he was also a martinet, and he was a bigot. And so if you did what he said, he was fine. And if you didn't, he was not fine. And he was astonished and seriously displeased when Quakers appeared in his domain. So that was something I wrote about, was very passionate about. And then trying to think of what's a next documentary. You know, when you finish one, you always think, well, what are you going to do next? And we thought of that episode, and then we thought, well, let's let's follow this forward. Let's take the story forward. And so we found ourselves, you mentioned the groups that we cover. We go from the Quaker experience in the 17th century to Baptists in late 18th century Virginia, both colonial and post-independence. And they had a very rough time at first. Virginia had an Anglican establishment. It treated Baptist ministers really, really roughly and nastily. I won't say fatally, certainly not, but just bullying and seriously unpleasant. Then we trace the efforts of Black Christian believers to run their own churches and have their own worship where they could set the terms of it, not be relegated to the galleries and the shadows as they often were in white churches. We talk about the Catholics, who there were always Catholics in what would become the United States, but the large numbers came in the early 19th century and the tensions that caused and the results of that influx. We talk about Mormons, which is one of America's made in America religions. There are a couple others, but Mormons are certainly the most numerous and the most successful. But it didn't look that way at first. They were very, very roughly handled. I would say probably the roughest of any of the groups we cover. So rough, in fact, that they decide in the late 1840s, we've had it. We can't live in the United States. We got to leave. We got to go to Mexico. Then the United States won the Mexican War, so when they got to Utah, it was no longer Mexico, but the United States. So they were, in a sense, like hook and ladders. They'd slid back down to the start. And then Jews, who began arriving in great numbers at the end of the 19th century. So those are the episodes, and I think you correctly discerned this pattern of people coming, and even when there is a commitment in law, in fundamental law, to religious liberty and free exercise, as we see in the First Amendment, it takes a while to make that real. It can take a while to make that real, but it does become real, and it's partly because of the efforts of the believers themselves. And I think it's partly because of that legal commitment and the commitment of enough Americans to it that the suspicion will be overcome, the oppression will be undone.
So, Rick, that's very interesting. And I want to actually focus a little bit on that first example you mentioned. I hadn't realized that was the genesis of the film, was actually the Flushing Remonstrance of 1657. And that's of interest to us here, because if you just drive 15 minutes from our campus, you get to the old Quaker Meeting House in Flushing. And I can remember as a kid in New York City public schools being taken to the John Bowne House in Flushing. And John Bowne is one of the people who was involved with the Flushing Remonstrance. And the film presents this as a victory for religious tolerance, which it certainly was. You know, the remonstrance says we don't want to persecute people because of their different religious opinion. We want to let them have their opinions and worship. But when I went back and looked at the Flushing Remonstrance, I went and looked online, and I was struck by the fact that the names were all English. They weren't Dutch. Now, you point out in the film, they weren't Quakers, and so this was a genuinely disinterested stand on their part. They were not defending their own rights, they were defending the rights of their neighbors. But their neighbors were English, as were they. And I wonder, and I think you see this throughout the film, I wonder how much of these conflicts that we have about religious freedom are about social and cultural differences, at least as much as they are about theological commitments. You know, so for example, maybe this is a fight between the English and the Dutch. In New Netherlands, maybe it's not really a fight between the Quakers and the Calvinists. What do you think about that?
Well, look, certainly that's a factor. If the Latter-day Saints had not embraced plural marriage very early on in their history, that was certainly an accelerant to the prejudice, which already existed. I mean, look, they started off in saying, hey, we found another Bible. you know, yeah, we like the Bible, but here's a whole other half of it that we dug up in upstate New York, and it shows that Jesus came to North America, and, you know, that's what we believe. And that is going to strike any Orthodox Christian as, you know, at least very odd. So there was already that going on. But to go back to the Quakers a little bit, yes, the people of Flushing were English. These Quakers were coming from England. New Netherlands was a very polyglot colony. I mean, even if you'd taken the English out of it, there was one of the, a Jesuit missionary who passed through there noted that, I think he said 18 languages were spoken in New Netherlands. So, wow. You know, New York City to come already had its character stamped on it in this.
Wow, I had no idea. That's really, I had no idea.
Sure. And, you know, because unlike Boston and unlike Philadelphia, those were holy experiments. But New York was always about money. It's about how much money can you make from the fur trade, you know? And if you've got something we need, come on. And so in a way, Stuyvesant was sort of going against the ethos of the very place he was sent to run. And he was a military man. That was his background. So he came into this job with a very military point of view. You know, in other words, if I say something, you all have to obey it. Now, and then at the end of this story, you know, he wants no Quakers at all. The men of Flushing sign a remonstrance saying, we cannot obey this directive of yours because we would treat them as we would wish to be treated. And our Savior saith, this is the law and the prophets. Okay, and then Stuyvesant arrests them all, or, you know, he arrests all the leaders. He forces them to recant. You know, he throws them in jail and feeds them bread and water and all this stuff. But then finally, his bosses back in Amsterdam say, you know, cut this out. We need the colony to prosper. We've got threatening neighbors. If people want to move there, let them move there and just ignore their religion. Then the British take it over, and it's not demographic pressure. They send an armada, sails into New York Harbor, and Stuyvesant capitulates. What is interesting is that in the articles of capitulation he signed, he stipulated that the people should continue to enjoy the liberties that they currently had, including religious ones. So it's odd that this guy who'd really stamped on it at the very end, when he's handing off the baton, he says, okay, let the status quo continue, which is something that the English did.
Yeah, I wonder, by the way, just I don't want to get into too much New York trivia, but I've always heard, Rick, that the Dutch surrendered without a shot. Is that right? That they just were sick of Stuyvesant and they gave up?
Well, he was the only one who wanted to fire. He was on the battery by himself with a cannon, you know, and then he was his son, the Dutch Reform minister, the merchants. They begged him not to do this because if a shot had been fired, then the town could be plundered. You know, and the rules of law get suspended, and, you know, they didn't want to see that. So finally, they were able to talk him out of this.
Oh, I see. And, you know, about when he says religious liberty, I wonder, too, whether, I don't know if you talked about this with Sophie von Beisterfeld or not. She's in the film, I know. She's a friend of ours. She's actually, we work with her here at the center. And I wonder if his idea of religious liberty was, you know, the Quakers, they can do what they want privately. They just can't do this publicly. I wonder if that's part of the flavor, too, that what they wanted was the right to publicly worship.
Yes, and Quakers, you know, we have to realize that Quakers then were rather different from Quakers now. I mean, they were very out there. Two of the first Quakers who were left in New Amsterdam, there were two women, and they were prophesying so loudly in the streets, people thought there was a fire, you know, and called out the fire company. Because they were probably saying, you know, the world is going to end soon. The fire is going to come down from heaven. You have to listen to us. So this was a very public and in a lot of ways disruptive religion, which would have made it even less acceptable to a man like Peter Stuyvesant.
Yeah, and that leads to another point that I wanted to make that I got from the film. And we talked about this a bit at Princeton, but I think it's an important point to make it again. You know, so when I think of Quakers, especially Quakers in the colonial period, you know, I think of very sober people, pacifists, very industrious. You know, I think of the Philadelphia Story, that 1940 film with, you know, they show what the Quaker ethos is. But they were not that way in the beginning. In fact, the film says they were, you know, they broke windows or broke bottles.
Bottles, I can't remember which.
Bottles, right. Okay, so this was, a kind of militant group. And they changed over time. And I think what you can see is that now look, one of the themes of the film is these religions make America a more tolerant place. And that is certainly true, right? And these groups that are seen as threatening to the fabric, like Quakers or Catholics or Mormons or other groups you talk about in the film, they are accepted and welcomed. But I think there's a flip side, and that is that America also changes religion. And so over time, there's a movement to the mean, and these religious groups eventually stop challenging social values in that way. They come to accept them, or at least they come to accept them sufficiently so that the tensions aren't there. Now, you mentioned Mormons, and you said the big problem was plural marriage. And in the film, you discuss a couple of 19th century cases, the Reynolds case and the Davis case, which are all about polygamy. But then, you know, the Mormons, they don't have polygamy anymore.
They had a revelation.
They had a revelation, right, when Utah was becoming a state. So that changes things. Or the Catholics, right? The Catholics, the 19th century Catholic Church was the church of the Syllabus of Errors, which said that religious liberty was, in fact, a problem, that you could not be admitted in a Catholic polity. But the 20th century is the church of Dignitatis Humanae, which makes an argument for religious liberty as a civil right. So you might say that one of the lessons here is that the religions themselves transform in a way that they transform America, these religions, but America transforms the religions as well.
Well, I think that's a very interesting point. I think it's true. We didn't state it explicitly in the film, but you can see that working. And I'll share again this poignant anecdote about Al Smith, the first Catholic to run for president on a major party ticket. And this is 1928, and, successful New York state politician, but now he's running nationally, and he gets hammered with a lot of 19th century encyclicals, like the one you mentioned. I think the Atlantic Monthly, you know, collected some of these and said, you know, all right, here, Governor Smith, well, what do you think of these encyclicals? And Smith is supposed to have said, will someone tell me what the hell an encyclical is?
Now, that is a great story.
I asked Cardinal Dolan if this was true, and he told me, yes, it was true. Now, was Smith actually ignorant, or was he making a joke of it? And I think what he was really saying, whether seriously or facetiously, was, will someone tell me, you know, Al Smith, now living in the early 20th century in America, what an anti-American encyclical could be? You know, I have grown up in this country. My church is flourishing in this country. We are loyal to it. It is fine with us. You know, what's all this Pius IX stuff you're throwing at me, and how could that be? I don't recognize that in my life as a Catholic in America.
And you don't think that's just because he's a politician, and politicians are often ignorant of these things? You think it was a broader statement as a Catholic he was saying that?
Well, look, I don't know that he was an intellectual, but he was a savvy guy, and certainly New York politics, if you know anything, you know about ethnicity and ethnic rivalries. So he probably was up on this kind of thing.
Yeah, that is a great quote. You know, and you mentioned before about our legal commitments, and there is a school of thought that says that the First Amendment, you know, the religion clauses of the First Amendment, which are based very much in a Lockean understanding that, you know, there are the things of civil government, and then there are the things of spirituality, and these things are not the same. That really the point of the Lockean understanding was that we try to make these religions more moderate. That's kind of a goal. Now, maybe that's not appropriate, right? But I wonder whether that isn't baked into liberalism.
Well, maybe it is, and that can be, you know, then there are going to be points where that sticks. For instance, plural marriage. I mean, you still... I'm sure it is against the law almost everywhere in the United States. we do see people challenging it. I mean, as part of a sexual revolution thing, also as a part of immigrants. You know, you read stories in New York City about an immigrant from Senegal, and he's got two wives because he's a Muslim, or maybe just an African polygamist. So that is by no means an absolutely dead issue.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. You know, look, as lawyers, we tend to exaggerate the importance of legal documents and legal texts in driving things. You know, we think that the First Amendment drives things. But another lesson of this film, it seems to me, is that it is the people themselves who have to drive this. And you mentioned that before, whatever the words say, if this is not in the hearts of the people, it's not going to go anyplace. You have any thoughts about
that?
Well,
yes. And one of the, I think it might be the most important line in the whole film. I mean, apart from the Flushing Remonstrance itself, which is my favorite, but of all our commentators that we feature in the film, Professor Akhil Amar from the Yale Law School, he says that courts protect rights and sometimes Congress protects rights. But unless free exercise lives in the hearts and minds of the American people, it's not going to endure. And that's precisely your point. If this is something that we care about, if this is something that we care to maintain, we will. If we don't, we won't. It will erode.
And do you think, I mean, I thought one of the implicit messages of the film was, and we can do it again. Now, there are these new groups in America which are seen as threatening and different. I mentioned Hindus, Muslims, Buddhists. Is it fair to say that's also one of the implicit messages of the film, is that we can get through these problems too, just as our forebears have?
Well, yes, I think we can, and it'll take work. You know, it will take work as it did in the 17th and 18th and 19th and 20th century.
Yeah, that was actually a very important lesson, I think, too, of the film, which is we shouldn't congratulate ourselves as having been angels straight along. You know, these were real conflicts that took place. So, Rick, where can people view this film? Are there broadcasts that are scheduled? I know there's a website.
Yes, there is a website. Go to the website. You know, I was born in 1955, so in my head, it's still three networks and educational television. All right, so I'm the wrong person to ask. I will be slaughtered by my comrades here for saying this. But do go to our website, and that's where the latest information will be. We're still about to pick a distributor for streaming, so that will happen very soon. There will also probably be some theatrical releases here and there. I mean, not in every Middlesex village and farm, but there will be some. We're also going to have some more screenings, as the one that you participated in at Princeton. So go to our website, and there you will be kept up to speed on all of this.
Great, and I will link that website in the description when we post this up on our website. So. Okay, well, thank you very much. Any final thoughts on the film that you want to say, Rick?
I hope people take it as seriously as the Men of Flushing did.
Well, that is a great way to end things. That is a great way to end things. So thank you very much, Rick. Listeners, this has been another episode of Legal Spirits, which is the podcast series of the Mattone Center for Law and Religion. You can find past episodes archived on streaming platforms like Apple iTunes and Android and Spotify. If you like us, please do subscribe. But that's it for now. See you next time.